KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
I'm a paleo nut, don't you understand?
Hey, Dave, it's good to see you again. Like, you were just here.
Dude, I was just in Ketchikan 3 days ago.
Well, it's just, you were so different, actually, in three dimensions, too. It was like I could reach out and I could see other aspects of you.
I know. I probably was smaller and even less hairier.
Actually, you didn't have glasses on maybe the whole time, did you?
Oh, well, I've got cataract surgery. I will never need glasses again. So
that's amazing.
I got bionic eyes. And I want to thank you for your unbelievable hospitality and your barbecue. Oh, my goodness. We had salmon one night. We had you fried up some cod. But
link
was it cod?
Link cod.
Yeah, we had fish and chips, mate.
And yeah, it was just great. Did that. Out of the back deck. It was good to see you, Dave. We went walking in the forest.
And I got a tour of your studio. And I even interviewed you, which we'll put on an episode.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
But you served us salmon on the barbecue grill. And I'd like to have anybody who can tell us the Latin name for the fish. What kind of fish is it?
We had sockeye salmon.
Sockeye salmon. Any of you listeners can go online and tell us the Latin name of that fish. You could win a t-shirt.
Oh. You didn't tell me about this. Well, I know a guy. I'm going to go tell the guy to, you know,
yeah.
I can
wear a shirt. So, leave us a message on our Facebook page, and you'll win a t-shirt.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. Well, cool, man. I love the shirt you're wearing, man.
Well, before we talk about our amazing guest
today. I'm so excited about the guest.
But before we get into it, you sent me a link about stromatolites.
Stromatolites.
So I want to talk about stromatolites for a bit. Because this article you sent, stromatolites are some of the earliest living animals on the planet. They're a colony of animals. They're cyanobacteria.
They are 3.4 billion years old.
That's
and
right.
And colonies, they're layers of algae. And I thought we should study up on this a little bit before we talk to our guest, because it's relevant to our guest today.
It is relevant. But I'd like to ask you, so these trillions and trillions of algae mats, or algae, is it algae or algae?
I think it depends upon what part of the country you're from, but it's algae to me.
So imagine thousands of square miles of these algae mats living for millions and millions.
Dave, you said algae again.
Algae mats living for millions and millions and millions.
It's algebra, not algebra. All right, okay.
Okay, you do the math, and I'll say algae.
Okay, all right.
Millions and millions and millions of years, they took in sunlight, and what is their byproduct?
They gave us oxygen.
That's right, and they literally populated our atmosphere with enough oxygen.
So that the next step could happen, man.
The next step of life, more complex cellular life could grow and evolve. And it's pretty amazing when you think about that life begat life.
Well, yeah, one thing leads to another. But where did life come from, man? How did it start?
This wasn't like in a lagoon somewhere. This was the entire planet Earth. They turned it from a very, a carbon dioxide and methane-rich atmosphere?
I don't know about young Earth, but basically they gave us,
They gave us atmospheric oxygen, and they terraformed this planet. I mean, that's on
and
a planetary scale.
Yeah, and the world was covered with stromatolites, right? I mean, there were these big mats of algae everywhere.
Well, there's two factors here, and I don't really know. Either there was a hell of a lot of them, but there...
I think there were a hell of a lot of them.
But for a very long time that they were oxygen-generating. And how long do you think that was? For half a billion years?
Well, I think they call it the boring billions, because nothing much happened during those billions of years, but... Stromatolites today, there's only a couple places on the planet. One is off the coast of Western Australia.
which you and I are going to visit next year.
I am so looking forward to that. And our guest actually today has actually been out there taking school groups out there. And the other one is in the Bahamas, I believe.
Oh, really?
So let's go there too.
Okay.
So we can see the living algal. Now you got me saying algal. Algal? Maybe it's algal. I don't know. Algal mats. It does sound better, doesn't it? Algal mats.
So. Okay. Let's talk about our guest. He's a keystone in the Mars 2020 Perseverance rover mission.
So yeah, we are talking with Ken Williford today. And I got to say, you know, you're always wearing the NASA t-shirts. You're wearing one today. It's not a troll shirt. And I know that you are probably more of a space nerd than a paleo nerd. So,
well, I wanted to be an astronaut. I was 12 when they landed on the moon in 69. I wanted to be an astronaut, and it was my grades that pretty much determined.
Should've
I couldn't
known
go.
Should have done your math, man.
I should have done my algebra. If you look behind me, if you look at all our screenshots behind me, is a scale model of the space shuttle, which I built and painted. I've been flying model airplanes. I was a pilot for 30 years in general aviation aircraft. So it's in my blood. Space and aviation is in my blood.
Yeah, I mean, that's so cool is that, you know, I know that you're into that stuff and we're doing this Paleo Nerd Show. And then it occurred to me one day, like, wait a minute. They're actually looking for life on Mars. There must be a paleontologist on their staff. How cool is that? And then I went to Googling and I found Ken. Then I watched a Nova show, and there was Ken talking about fossils on Earth and then fossils on Mars, what they're looking for. And I sent him an email. I dropped my name. Also, we've got some...
Did he know you? Had he heard of you?
Well, we've had a previous guest on, and I mentioned our previous guest. He's actually worked with Peter Ward.
Oh, right.
So
That's right.
I mentioned Peter Ward's name.
Good.
He wrote right back. It was great. I was stunned. But they literally living on Martian time.
Yes, yes. The Mars day is, which is called a sol. Day is 24 hours and 40 minutes. So it's 40 minutes longer than ours. And as I'm talking to you right now, because we're going to be talking to him in about 20 minutes, it is 5:07 in the evening.
So wait a minute. The Martian day is longer than our day?
Yes, by 40 minutes.
By 40 minutes. So the thing is,
do you know why they live on Mars time? I mean, if it's only 40 minutes, why do you think they live on Mars time?
Because from what I understand, Dave, what happens when we shift our Earth time, that's no big deal. We can adapt to it. But if you switch to Martian time, that 40 minutes then begins to add up. And eventually you're not even waking up on Mars. They're trying to wake up when the Martian day starts, right?
Correct. So. And that all has to do, and this is my theory, they have to charge their batteries every day. They have to be monitoring, you know, this solar accretion. However, there is a plutonium reactor which is powering Perseverance. Plutonium.
Really?
Did you know they launched that thing with a bunch of nuclear stuff in it without pretty much any fanfare? Because if that thing had come down in a suburb somewhere. Yeah. Anyway, but we'll get Ken to maybe or maybe not discuss that. But yeah, we'll ask him about his sleep schedule. Another Mars mission specialist said it's like having a newborn. You are woken up in the middle of the night and you got to get used to it. And that's how it is.
So. Yeah, I wonder if they have a little place where they're all on Mars time, hanging out on Mars time. But yeah, they have to go to sleep. And I want to ask him about his paleo background. Yeah. And then we'll get way deep into what they're looking for on Mars. Man, this is so exciting, Dave. I'm really thrilled.
I know. So let's give him a ring. You know what? I'd like to use my... that space phone from the film 2001 A Space Odyssey. The guy makes
Dave.
A video call.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we'll do that.
You've got that one.
Yeah.
Hey, Dave, meet Ken Williford, astrobiologist, deputy project scientist for the NASA Mars 2020 Perseverance rover mission, and director of the Jet Propulsion Lab's Astrobiogeochemistry Laboratory. Ken, really good to meet you here in cyberspace, and that's my buddy Dave Strassman there wearing a NASA shirt.
Yeah, well, I always wear NASA shirts, but Ken, congratulations on a very successful mission to date, and you and all the team members must be over the moon, or Mars, so to speak, with your current successes. Welcome.
Indeed. Well, thanks a lot. It's great to virtually meet you all as well, and thanks for the kind words. We are all very excited.
Well, nothing's really gone wrong so far. I mean, it's been an amazing mission to date.
I'm waiting for the grand announcement that's going to happen on this show, right?
Well, I'm going to ask about the grand announcement if it ever comes later on. Right.
I thought we were going to do it today. But
I've been saving it up for you guys.
Yeah.
Thanks, man.
But yeah, I think things have gone remarkably well. We're really impressed with how the team has come together, and it's taken a lot of hard work and, as always, you know, some luck and a lot of skill. And yeah, things have broken our way in a number of occasions. So yeah, we all are very fortunate to be.
And I didn't know that the Perseverance rovers really grandfathered technology from the previous two rovers. So you almost had, you know, a massive template that was proven.
That's right. Yeah, there are certain elements that have been shared to sort of the basic design, or what you might even call the architecture of the rovers, that stretches back all the way through the whole lineage back to Sojourner, the little, you know, demonstration on the Pathfinder mission. But in a much more important way, we share a lot of heritage, as we call it, with the Curiosity rover, the previous rover, and as much as possible used a build-to-print approach to both take advantage of all that great design that went into Curiosity, and also for efficiency, you know, to save time, and everything. Yeah,
it was more efficient. But I think, Dave, we like to usually start out with one very important question.
Very important question. Ken, are you a paleo nerd?
I could definitely be described as a paleo nerd. Yes, no question about it.
Well, that's cool. I want to get a little bit into your background. You're living in Seattle right now, but did you start out as a dinosaur loving kid, and now you're a scientist for NASA?
I did. Yeah, I started out as a dinosaur loving kid for sure. Yeah. I was one of those kids. My daughter is turning out to be one of those dinosaur lovers, as a lot of them are. But yeah, I actually attribute my original interest to the first time I snorkeled on a coral reef. That's sort of when it struck me to really understand life more generally. And I think it was that motivation that had me fascinated by dinosaurs, and then ultimately led me to, you know, focus on paleontology of the big things, like I think probably most of you all talk about, and then move, more recently in my career to smaller and smaller organisms, the microbes and so forth.
Yeah.
And then,
I'm interested in that transition, though. You actually worked with Peter Ward on mass extinctions, and you went up to Haida Gwaii and you looked at the Triassic-Jurassic extinctions, and that leap that you took from paleontology suddenly to this new field of astrobiology. What happened there? How did you start digging into it? You were looking at ancient life on Earth, and then it led you to this bigger question.
Well, I must point out Haida Gwaii is an island south pretty much of Ketchikan and north of Vancouver Island, right? And but is there a Triassic boundary? Is there a Triassic-Jurassic boundary that you can look at?
There is. Yeah, there's a beautifully exposed Triassic-Jurassic boundary section at a place we call Kennecott Point. And then there's some a bit older rocks going down onto Frederick Island, which is, just adjacent to Kennecott Point. And you can study the Norian-Racian boundary there in the end of the Triassic.
Are those ages, Norian-Racian?
Yes, yeah.
From the?
The Triassic.
Right.
Triassic, where it meets the Jurassic. And that's kind of a little-known extinction, at least with the general public. What did you and Dr. Ward figure out was going on there at that?
Yeah, well, it's funny. So it has always been one of the quote big five, the sort of that I think mostly came out of Jack Sepkoski's work with the diversity curve through time in the Phanerozoic, and these five major mass extinctions at roughly at period boundaries. It's always been in that group, but I know when I started out working on it back then in grad school, pretty much every paper, or it was so common to say, oh, the Triassic-Jurassic is one of the least studied of the big five. And a lot of that at the time we imagined had to do with the sea level situation and the balance between deposition and erosion and maybe how most of the Triassic-Jurassic boundary sequences were eroded away. But we do have a number of really precious ones, and more work has been done. It's hard for me to say it's less studied now. There are a lot of great people doing a lot of great work on it. It's one thing, I mean, it's interestingly sandwiched between the two most famous, I would say, and clearly the most famous is the most recent, if you don't count, you know, the current situation,
right? Yeah.
When the dinosaurs went extinct and the ammonoids, but bracketed with the Permian Triassic, which is the largest, the Triassic Jurassic sits right in between those two, you know. And I guess one other big major point I'd make about it that's interesting to me is that kind of at the geology 101 level, when you first start to study plate tectonics, at least I did, I learned that you want to think about Pangaea forming. We think about it forming in an association with the Permian-Triassic boundary, in temporal association with that, and maybe connected to the mass extinction, formation of a supercontinent for various ways. Pangaea really starts to authentically break apart or disintegrate around the Triassic-Jurassic boundary, and we start moving into this more modern distribution of continents. And so it's interesting to me. I don't know, you know, there's a connection. I can think of reasons why there would be connection between formation and disintegration of supercontinents as something that may be difficult for animal life to cope with.
I saw a recent animation of the last billion years, and the bits of Pangaea break apart and move across the globe. But what you're looking at is millions of 10.0 earthquakes. That doesn't happen like an amoeba crawls across. It's slower than that, but there must be cataclysmic events that create the breakup of an entire continent to land in the positions the continents are in today. But did any papers come out of that Triassic-Jurassic study on Haida Gwaii?
Yes, several have come out. So one kind of stimulated my own work on it was Peter had a paper in Science that was a bulk organic carbon isotope record across that section, right at the boundary, showing a major shift in the carbon isotope compositions of organic matter, and starting to interpret that as maybe an effect of the mass extinction, or related to the cause or related to the effect, but related anyway to the mass extinction. And
that the atmosphere composition.
Yeah, well, that gets to a comment I was going to make about your comment about the 10.0 earthquakes. Certainly, yeah, I think about the, Pangaea starting to split up as associated with a lot of cataclysmic events, but then sort of all those events conspire together to make a major change in the ocean atmosphere state, whether it's the physical and chemical properties of both the ocean and the atmosphere. And then it's the biosphere that is, I think, reacting to those changes and sort of having to adapt to in some cases, maybe a very new situation that perhaps then recovers to some other stable state. But it's tightly associated with this change in the atmosphere, which is what has always also made it very interesting to me in terms of today's situation and what we may be getting ourselves into. Both the Permian Triassic and the Triassic Jurassic do not appear to be obviously associated with impact events like the end Cretaceous event does. And instead, we'd say perhaps they were caused by intrinsic, as distinct from extrinsic, forces. The extrinsic forces
on this planet.
Exactly. Yes. Our planet shifted on its own to a new state that was difficult in many ways for biology. And
Well, if anything, that the idea that the Earth, we're lucky to really be here. The more I study paleontology, the deeper I get into it. All the stuff our planet has been through, and maybe in a way that kind of leads me to this. There were two planets side by side once upon a time, and life may or may not have occurred on both of them at the same time. When did that idea start taking hold in your life and lead to your current career?
Yeah, you're talking about the concept of panspermia and exchange between Earth and Mars. Potentially, yes. Is that what you're alluding to? Yeah,
that's what I'm alluding to, and I guess it's transpermia, which is
which planet seeded who? Yeah.
Right. Well, that's one of the big questions, and this really gets to the heart of what we're trying to do with Mars 2020 and with Mars sample return. Beyond that, we are really, I think, for the first time since Viking, very directly seeking evidence of extraterrestrial life with a major NASA mission. We've been doing it in a sense for quite some time, with every Mars rover has been motivated to some degree by this search for life beyond Earth, but it's been this stepwise, careful approach to the problem, following the water, looking at habitability. And now we're building on all that and saying we directly seek the evidence of life. But where we're very different from Viking is we are searching for evidence of very ancient life, or extinct life, likely extinct life, but anyway, very ancient, as opposed to extant life, you know, the things that are recently deceased or currently alive. That's not what 2020 or Mars Sample Return are about in their current conception, but it's about this idea that you mentioned, where long ago, you know, between 3 and 4 billion years ago, Earth and Mars, we think, may have been much more similar than they are today. And since then, they've taken these divergent paths, where Earth has remained a very, very habitable, ubiquitously habitable planet. Mars, the surface of Mars, as far as we can tell, it has become a very inhospitable place by contrast, and the atmosphere that we think Mars must have had, the thicker atmosphere to support abundant surface water, seems to have escaped at some point during that, wow, that 3 billion years of history. So what's that about? Maybe Mars lost its magnetic field, and several things. And we're looking at this question broadly that we call planetary evolution, but we're going, so we want to understand how Mars evolved as a planetary system, but we're going back into the deepest reaches of Martian history to look at that time when Mars was apparently very habitable, more like Earth, perhaps still less habitable in a sense than Earth, and we can talk about what that might even mean, but a time when, as you say, one of the possibilities that opens up is exchange of organisms between the two planetary neighbors. Wow. And then raises the question, that we just heard, you know, did life originate on Mars or did life originate on Earth, and exchange back and forth? And there are arguments that have been made, you know, on either side of that, but just very interesting questions.
What I just learned is that the geologic history of Mars is divided into four broad segments. There are periods, and I never knew this, but they're based on the rate of impact crater density. So yeah, obviously earlier in the formation of our solar system, there was a lot of these impact bodies. And tell me, where is the Jezero crater in relation to the age of Mars?
Yeah, well, great question. And indeed, the ages that we associate with really anything, any extraterrestrial body other than the moon, these bodies in the solar system, we assign ages based on the frequency and size distribution, or call it the size frequency distribution of craters. And the way we calibrate that age relation is with the analyses that we've made of samples returned from the lunar surface, where we can calculate the size frequency distribution of craters and assign those to absolute ages that we recover on Earth. So for Mars, it's been divided broadly into these, the Hadean, the Noachian, the Hesperian, and the Amazonian.
Wow.
in time order, from oldest to youngest there. We believe that Jezero is somewhere right around that Noachian-Hesperian boundary. And it sits on the western edge of a much larger impact feature called Isidis. And Isidis is either, you know, right on that boundary, or perhaps, you know, before that boundary, Noachian.
My notes say Noachian is 4.1 to 3.7 billion years ago. Now, what was life on Earth doing at 4.1 billion years ago?
Well, we really don't know, because we don't have any rocks that are that old. Preserved on Earth.
Okay, so let's get back to the first life on the evidence on Earth. Sure.
Well, before we jump into that, I just want to clarify what you're talking about with the crater impacts that you're calculating. Let me, help me out here, because I'm more of a paleo nerd than a space nerd.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that you determine the age of different planets is you're looking at the craters, right? It's the ages of the rocks that are exposed. But the...
Let me stop you, just briefly stop you. Okay. Yeah, so... the way you said it was the way we determine the age of the different planets. Maybe you're aware of this, but we think of the planets as all roughly the
right.
The ages of different surfaces on different planets.
Surfaces. All right. So yeah, I realize the solar system is all happens basically at the same time, but you have figured out by looking at the lunar surface craters that are there, also the asteroids, the comets that are hitting, are also hitting other planets at the same, about roughly the same time. Is that what you're doing?
That is one of the built-in assumptions. And there are different models for how that happened. And
think of a lot of meteor storms a long time ago, not so many now.
That's the basic thing. And then you throw in the slightly added complexity of two different models for how that actually that size distribution relates to age. And then also this idea of the late heavy bombardment, where it appears from our lunar data and these relations between size distribution and age, there appears to have been kind of a late stage pulse. So it wasn't just this monotonic decrease in size distribution and frequency. There was a decrease, and then on that is superimposed this pulse. And we don't know that that happened, but it's built into our model of solar system evolution that may have happened.
The nemesis star.
Yeah.
It's coming again sometime.
Yeah, but one of the potential causes is something like that. Yeah.
So you are a paleontologist by training academically, and you were looking at really ancient rocks. What are, and Dave was asking this too, let's get back into how do we know the oldest rocks on Earth and what are they and where do we see life?
But most importantly, what do you extrapolate from looking at the oldest rocks on Earth with life in them to the evidence you hope to find in the Mars 2020?
Yeah, well, so getting to the oldest record of life on Earth, just give you my own... hopefully short version of how I think about it. So first of all, we have the age of the Earth as determined not from a piece of Earth, but from a meteorite, the Canyon Diablo troilite. And that's what gives us the age of that formation of the solar system, formation of significantly sized solid bodies in the solar system. Then we have the oldest Earth material that's ever been dated. Are little sand grains, zircon grains. From a rock called the Jack Hills metaconglomerate.
In Western Australia, right?
Western Australia, exactly. And the rock itself is about 3 billion years old, but it was formed in a stream bed that was flowing down from some mountain or hillside. The rocks that made up that mountain or hillside were 4.4 billion years old. And then those eroded into sand grains, flowed into a stream, maybe through multiple episodes of mountain formation and weathering and erosion and so forth. But in any case, the zircon crystals themselves formed in the solid Earth, in the crust of the Earth, 4.4 billion years ago, then were eroded out and trapped in a rock 3 billion years ago. We dug them up, in the broader sense, we dug them up and measured their age. Then, so we don't have any rocks that are that old. Then we have a couple places on Earth. One is in a place called Nuagatuk in Canada, so sort of in the middle of the Canadian shield, this continental shield that's been protected from or shielded from tectonic forces that have destroyed all the other rocks of that age. We have a couple places on Earth where extremely old rocks are preserved, but they're highly metamorphosed, fairly highly metamorphosed. This is Nuagatuk and then a place in Greenland. And then it's not until 3.5 billion years ago that we start to preserve a record that has not been very significantly metamorphosed. And those records are best seen in Western Australia, a place called the Pilbara, and in South Africa. And I've mostly worked in the Pilbara, on these rocks, but they're beautifully preserved. They, famously, people look at them and you can't tell if it's a Cretaceous rock or in fact, it's early Archean, so 3.5 billion years old.
Wow.
And it's in these rocks, in the oldest, sufficiently well-preserved sedimentary rocks, that we have very clear evidence that life was present. We can all agree on that. Anyone who works on this subject can agree that there's very good evidence that 3.5 billion years ago in the form of stromatolites, that really there's no, I would say, no real significant counter argument about these 3.5 billion year old stromatolites in the Dresser Formation. And there are other examples similar age. And then it gets really good in the Strelley Pool Formation about 3.4 billion years ago. But we can all pretty much agree on that. Then there are a few pieces of evidence in older rocks at 3.7 to 3.8 to, you know, and higher in these more highly altered rocks. Those are all, I would say, controversial. You know, you'll find people who strongly believe them, people who strongly disbelieve them, and then people in between. But all I can very confidently say is we have good evidence of these fossilized microbial mats at 3.5 billion years ago, which tells us that life almost certainly did not emerge on Earth at, you know, 3.5 billion years ago plus 24 hours. It was, you know, some significant interval of time elapsed for what we would call prebiotic chemistry. Some people don't like that term, but it basically the chemistries that would eventually lead to the emergence of life unfolding for some amount of time, and then some shift happened. You know, it's got to be some fuzzy boundary where life emerged. We often use this term origin of life. Some people don't like that, partly because of the panspermia idea. And, you know, where exactly is that bright line between prebiotic chemistry in quotes and biochemistry? That's a hard thing. And we don't have rocks that are sufficiently well preserved, in my view, on Earth to really address that question geologically yet, as far as we know. But on Mars, we could get rocks like that. Even on the moon, fantastically, there could be Earth rocks that are that old that have been preserved via meteorite impacts and exchange with the moon, but then not destroyed by plate tectonics. So
ejecta from the Earth.
From the Earth, yeah, hitting the moon.
These are sort of pre-stromatolite rocks that you're referring to. Maybe there's a possibility.
Are stromatolites eukaryotes?
I just wanted to ask, because we were talking about this before we talked to you, Ken. Were stromatolites all over the planet? Were there just mats of the algae everywhere on the planet?
Presumably. I mean, that's how I think about it.
Well, they terraformed our planet.
They gave us oxygen, right?
Absolutely they did. Absolutely. Okay. Well, absolutely. As far as we can, you know, at least my own personal reading of the geochemical record or the biogeochemical record. And this is really what I do more than classic paleontology. I'm more a geochemist, an organic geochemist, biogeochemist, if you like. I use stable isotopes a lot. But it's partly because a lot of the rocks I work on were deposited long before there were ever, you know, multicellular animals and plants like a lot of quote, paleontologists work on. But anyway, so the stromatolites are broadly distributed, at least in all the rocks that we have that are that old, and they're very few. They're very few on Earth. They all have stromatolites in them. So as far as we know, stromatolites appeared as soon as we have rocks that are preserved well enough to have a clear stromatolite in it, those rocks have clear stromatolites in them, and all those rocks do.
You're not really expecting to find stromatolites on Mars, are you?
Well, that's a tough question, but I'll put it a little bit differently.
You'd be surprised if you did? Yeah, let me ask you.
No, I would be surprised in a sense of like overjoyed surprise and, you know, exuberance. But on one hand, it's a needle in a haystack type problem. So we know where these good stromatolites are on Earth because many geologists have gone year after year after year after year looking at these and looking for older and older rocks and, you know, bringing back as much many samples as they want, you know, back to the lab and looking at them with all the different techniques we have at our disposal. On Mars, even with all this great investment and all the great successes of the rover programs and other programs, in a sense, we're scratching the surface, literally.
It's a very narrow view of what you have.
That's right, and so, just because it's so much harder to make that field trip, you know, and so far humans can't even do it yet, so we have to send these robots, but this is a huge deal to be able to get samples back. It's our first ability to do that, which is a big part of it. And then the last piece I'll say is we went through about a 5-year process open to any scientist on the planet who wanted to come and debate the merits of all the different places we could possibly land on Mars. And we ended up where we are at Jezero, and some pretty significant technical advances were made to even enable this spot. And so if life existed at that time on Mars, there is good reason to believe that it's preserved in the rocks at Jezero crater.
And it just might be something like a stromatolite along that edge. It could be.
Yeah, if I had to predict what it would look like, I would predict a stromatolite.
Okay,
yeah.
Wow. Okay,
one of the instruments on the Perseverance rover is the SuperCam, which shoots a laser. It generates plasma, which then you analyze it using a spectroscopy instrument, right? So you're actually able to see the chemical makeup of the vapor created from this laser. I mean, it's so futuristic and Marvel's Avenger, but it could potentially detect organic matter. So walk me through how you would do that here on Earth, get samples, define what is life, and then what are you looking for on Mars with this instrument?
Yeah, so it's a big question. There's a lot there, but I'll say broadly speaking about the instruments on Mars 2020, the big theme, I would say, you know, we're driven, we're motivated by this need to seek evidence of life, right? It's not our job to find evidence of life because maybe it's not there, but it is our job to very carefully and seriously look for that evidence. And the way we do that on Mars with 2020 is very similar from the way we do it on Earth. And that's by looking in ancient rocks. We look for the oldest rocks we can that are the best preserved examples that we can find of those very old rocks. And then we look for lifelike shapes. Stromatolites are an example.
Okay, right.
And we look for lifelike compositions. We run those searches in parallel to an extent, but really all in the interest of running them together simultaneously. So because the ideal thing we're looking for in terms of evidence for life is where lifelike compositions occur in lifelike shapes. So where those things occur together. And we can then ask the question, is there any so-called abiotic or non-biological process that could lead to this set of features being observed here by our instruments in this context? Can we think of any mechanism to form all of these things that we see that doesn't require biology? That's sort of the harshest test of the null hypothesis for any interesting thing we find. So squiggles in a rock, organic matter in a rock.
Oh, dendrites.
Yeah, dendrites is an example.
Yeah, they look like plants, but they're not. Yeah.
Botryoidal mineral growth. So botryoid, like a bunch of grapes. So minerals that grow in those sorts of shapes. You can form many things that look lifelike on one hand, but don't at all require life. Same thing with the chemistries. You can form organic matter. You know, planets themselves, independent of living organisms, can form organics of some complexity. So, you know, several different types of organic molecules, a spectrum of organic molecules. We know organic molecules form and change in space without biological activity. So no one thing is generally enough. You know, there are some shapes that can be observed in the rock record that really go very, very far towards convincing us that they're biological. But certainly, I would say almost certainly, but really certainly, we will require not only information beyond the shapes themselves or the morphologies, we'll require there to be chemical evidence, probably multiple types of chemical evidence associated with those shapes. And then furthermore, to get those samples back and analyze them on Earth, I predict we would require all those things to come close to any sort of real consensus scientific agreement that we have indeed found evidence of ancient life on Mars. The stakes are so high, the burden of proof is going to be
enormous
as well. Yeah.
So basically, if it looks like a fossil, right? That's what you're saying. If it looks like the shape looks like a fossil,
yep.
You got the ripple marks. It looks like a stromatolite. You get super excited, or maybe there's the grape shapes, as you said. But then you've got to do.
You have to have the evidence. The
ability. Then you have no, but then you have the ability to do a chemical test.
That's right.
Basically, on it to see if it's got the compounds of life, and that's CHNOPS. Is that CHN, well, yeah, that,
that's
OPS.
One set of things we look for. So those are often called the biologically essential
elements. So you're
able
to grind that rock and then see if it's got that. But then the ultimate proof is that you've got to get those
rocks. Wait, Schnapps is
well,
carbon?
Just one sec. Yeah. You've got to get those rocks back to Earth then before we get in the
Well, we're going to get onto the Mars sample return mission.
Anyways, what is well, I can tell you what Schnapps is in my understanding.
Tell me,
we
Ray.
Have a world, no, we have the world's one of the world's experts here. What's Schnapps?
Yeah, it's a drink that you often get in Switzerland after skiing.
Have you guys? That's the joke that I've been waiting. I'm going to draw that. Has there been a Schnapps yet?
I've been milking it. No, but that's a great corporate.
I will do that for you, man. I'm going to do a Schnapps.
Excellent. So. Okay. No, Schnapps. C H N O P S. That's carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, and sulfur. All chemical elements that all known life requires those elements in a very important, you know, way. They're sort of fundamental to biochemistry as we know it. And then, but that doesn't mean that those are the only elements that living organisms need or build themselves from. But yeah.
Well, Alien was silicon based, so
right. So that's one whole concept, silicon-based life or alternative chemistries other than carbon-based organic chemistry. But in terms of the biochemistry that we know of, there are those Schnapps elements that are just so core to life as we know it. Then there are many others that are associated with life and required by many organisms. And so lots of them, they happen to be in many cases the same as the elements that make up the rock-forming minerals. So silicon, magnesium, iron, you know, calcium, potassium, all these are familiar to people. And turns out when you do a chemical analysis of the surface of Mars, what are the elements that you find? You find silicon, oxygen, magnesium, iron, calcium, potassium, you know, all these rock forming elements. Then the question is, do you see these other things? And certainly we see plenty of sulfur around on Mars. There's oxygen is one, you know, shared by both groups. We see phosphorus, hydrogen is all over the place. Most of the rocks we see are hydrated. I think that's to some extent the, you know, where did that atmosphere go? Well, you know, when Mars had a thicker atmosphere, when there was abundant surface water, there would have been water in the atmosphere as well, just simply through exchange and some kind of water cycle. Some of that water, a lot of it, maybe most of it, escaped to space. Some of it was left behind in the Martian rocks. And so we see that. Then carbon is the big question.
That's one
of the major things that led us to Jezero was the observation from orbit that we have carbonate minerals preserved in and around Jezero crater. And in fact, the region where Jezero is kind of the major hotspot on the planet for carbonate minerals. And carbonates do not require the presence of biology, nor are they organic. They're inorganic, but they are often associated with biology. So coral reefs are made of carbonate minerals, seashells are made of carbonate minerals, and so forth. And so commonly they're associated, but the key, whether or not Mars was ever inhabited, carbonate minerals get their carbon and oxygen through this process of exchange at what we call the critical zone between the solid planet, the crystalline rock of the planet, the atmosphere, the gaseous envelope, and then any water that's sitting in between. We call that interface the critical zone. Carbonate minerals form at that critical zone, you know, through interaction of the atmosphere, water, and rock, and they are preserved easily for billions of years, and they lock in a record of those environments.
Water becomes a precipitate for these carbonate materials, these carbonate minerals?
These carbonate minerals precipitate in water.
In water, okay.
Yeah.
And so if you were to, obviously you'd have to take your sample back to Earth and study it on a secondary ion mass spectrometer, which is one of the things you use. Mm-hmm. What would you like to see tomorrow when they shoot the SuperCam on a rock 3 meters away? What do you have, a range of like 22 meters or 11 meters, something like that? It's far.
Yeah,
it would hurt you if you were standing in front. It would hurt you.
Zap you.
Yeah, it would be totally unsafe. We don't put it on the dummy rover. Yeah.
You get an email and it says, Ken, we found this ion or isotope or carbon 13 and carbon 12, what would it be that you would like to see that would make you sit up in your chair?
Yeah, if we saw, so the SuperChem has generally a range of about several meters. We try to look at targets within about 5 to 7 meters. But SuperChem uses multiple techniques. One is the one we've discussed previously, where a plasma is generated and a spectrometer looks at the plasma. That's called LIBS, laser-induced breakdown spectroscopy. SuperChem has another technique called Raman. LIBS gives us elemental chemistry, like we were just talking about. Raman gives us information about the chemical bonds that are in there and the molecular composition. So that can tell us, is there organic matter there? But even if no organic matter, it can tell us what kind of minerals are present, because minerals, you know, are made of these bonds between those elements in a particular crystal structure. And Raman tells us about that. So what would make me super excited is to say, hey, Ken, we looked at this rock 3 meters away and it has wrinkly layered domes in its structure, and we find hints of carbon hydrogen bonds and aromatic carbon bonds, sort of benzene rings preserved in this rock from SuperChem Raman. That would all make me very, very excited. And part of that is
so because, the morphology first and then the chemicals.
Well, both together. So right. Is the key. And so if we saw something like that with SuperChem, that is, if we saw evidence of organic matter with SuperChem, that would tell us that there's a lot of organic matter there, because yes, SuperChem can detect organic matter, but our main tool for really for detection of organic matter on this mission is Sherlock, just because Sherlock operates right above the surface of the rock, so a few centimeters away from the rock, and uses a laser, same technique basically, but with an ultraviolet
more
laser
precise.
And scans it over the, it's more sensitive, yeah, is the key. And so we can see, anyway, that instrument's just much more sensitive because it's not trying to see at a distance. So SuperChem, the big advantage, okay, it's not quite as sensitive, but we can see before we ever park at an outcrop and we spend the time and energy to pull out the robotic arm and use our other instruments, Pixel and Sherlock, we can evaluate different outcrops from afar or different rocks from afar and make good choices on where to park the rover. So SuperChem would be just astounding if we saw it in there. But anyway, even if we saw some kind of tantalizing hints with SuperChem, we would drive up to that rock, we would deploy the arm, we would take a beautiful picture with the Watson camera, part of the Sherlock instrument.
Sherlock and Watson,
great color image from a couple few centimeters away. And then we would use the Pixel instrument to generate a map across those textures of elemental composition. The textures are like the shapes in the rock, the wrinkly layers in the case of this fantasy stromatolite we're describing. Pixel might show us that the mineralogy on you know, alternating layers is a little bit different, and that, you know, certain layers are enriched in some element relative to another. And then we'd map the same area with Sherlock, and maybe we would find that those you know, certain layers that are enriched in a particular element are also enriched in organic matter in the form of these CH bonds and aromatic carbon. And that would be just about the best situation we could imagine in terms of our ability, you know, a set of evidence that would say, wow, this is a very strong potential biosignature. Surely we would take a core of that rock and bring it back for future analysis on Earth.
What I thought was so cool when Perseverance first landed and some of the images started coming back and you're looking around, there was actually, I think in the NASA page, they were asking for people to, if you have ideas on where they should look, you know, for fossils. And I thought, I was looking around, there's a lot of juicy strata all over that, all over the crater there. It's incredible. You're 5 months in, there's got to be some cool stuff so far that you've been finding.
Oh, yes. And it just keeps building and building. I mean, we have been, it may surprise some folks, but even, you know, approaching 6 months after landing, we're still, this rover is so complex and capable that it takes us a long time, all these months, to check out and use each new capability for the first time. And the first time we do anything significant and new, we do it with extra special care, you know, with a little bit more looking over the plan and then looking over the results and seeing how it went. So we're still in that process that we expect to culminate really in an important sense with our first sample that should come within the next month on plan. But there's so much that leads up to that.
So you're just finishing up the checkout stage and you're about to turn into the science.
Well, sort of.
It's all science,
we are.
But...
Yeah. So that's the great news, is that, you know, maybe we're operating a little more slowly because we're being more careful. But every new thing we check out, we do it on a science target. So it's not just the engineers with free rein, kind of whatever the hell they, you know, we want to look at. It's you know, scientists and engineers working very close together. The engineers say, okay, the first time we do this, we got to be extra careful. Maybe we can't get quite as close. The scientists say, all right, well, this is the target that we want you to try to hit. And the engineers go, that one's a little pokey. So we move it slightly over there.
Drive over there.
Oh, yeah.
It's all there. That's
the whole thing. Yeah. The scientists are clamoring for more, more, more. The engineers are.
I can imagine the debate. So you're actually you're about to do the drilling. You're about to do a core.
Yeah, we're coming up on that, and we have done tons of work analyzing these rocks that we variably call the pavers or the polygons. It's this polygonally fractured unit, which we landed on at the Octavia E. Butler landing site, right on the border of a region we call Sitau. So we added that name after landing because we were located in the Canyon de Chelly Quad. We happened to just land in the quad we had named Canyon de Chelly, that a team member had mapped. So the team divided up the quads of the landing site and made geologic maps of each. And then there was this great effort to combine them all into one big map. We landed in that Canyon de Chelly quad. So we started assigning names in the Navajo language, working with the Navajo people for a list of names. And one of the names we applied to this region, Sita, and that means among the sands or amidst the sands. And it's this sort of mitten-shaped feature full of sand dunes that we can't really drive across because it's either too dangerous and impossible, or even if there was a route, it would take so long that it just wouldn't be practical. So we're skirting the boundary, and we're doing driving a lot as we test out our autonomous navigation capabilities, a sort of self-driving car version of the rover software. We can drive further and further each sol, and we make progress around that boundary. We've been seeing tons of great rocks.
Now, didn't the Ingenuity helicopter on its ninth flight actually became an aerial scout and showed you that the Sita dunes were there and added to the mission, and that's changing the path of the rover?
That's right. Well, yeah, it was this huge success by the Ingenuity team, and we were fortunate after the original technology demonstration of five flights for Ingenuity and kind of this very tight box they lived in. It went so well how that original tech demo unfolded that NASA requested an extended operations demonstration. So an ability for the Ingenuity team and a very small team at the interface of the rover team and the helicopter team to try to plan flights that would have minimal impact on the core rover mission. So we can't overly burden the rover team with, can you drive there, tweak this or that? Just have to kind of operate as a little autonomous team and fly the helicopter for a while, kind of leapfrog along with the rover, and then make this big giant leap across Sita. And it was incredibly exciting. So I've been fortunate enough to be on that little interface team, and it's been one of the highlights of, honestly, of my professional life.
Flying around Mars,
it's just astounding. Yeah, I mean, it's so
can we see
fun.
Video of that flight from Ingenuity?
Yeah, it's on the website.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
On the website. So, very important. Have you been involved in the Mars sample return mission? And if you have, well, I'm sure you have been. But if you could explain I love robotics. I use it in my job. And the ACA, which is the adaptive caching assembly, it is like a Coke bottle plant. You make these cores and you stick them in these tubes. They're sealed, and you're going to drop them and leave them in various places on the surface of Mars for later pickup.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
And the document's been signed for that mission. That mission will be happening. Explain. Can you give us a little?
It's on the Europeans to come through now, right?
Well, yeah, it's a major partnership between NASA and the European Space Agency to get these follow-on missions done, to get those samples back. It's two different missions that'll be required, a lander that itself will likely have a small rover associated with it called the Fetch Rover, and it will also have a rocket called the Mars Ascent Vehicle. And so it's the job of that mission to be on the surface, go get our samples off the ground, and or have Perseverance deliver samples to the lander, maybe some combination, and then get them into the top of that rocket, launch them into Mars orbit in a container called the Orbiting Sample, the OZ, or at least it has been called that for some time, and then where it meets rendezvous with another mission, the Orbiter, the Sample Return Orbiter, that flies to Mars, and they, both missions get to Mars around the same time. The Orbiter is there for the whole sequence to help observe the landing of the lander and do communications relay for that landed mission, and then to monitor the launch of the orbiting sample such that the Orbiter can then rendezvous with the sample, capture it. The sample is now a collection of our tubes that we collected with Mars 2020, something like 30 titanium tubes. Rendezvous with that, capture it, and then fly back to Earth and land, you know, somewhere in Utah, perhaps, and then get picked up, brought to some facility, evaluated for Earth safety, and then eventually we get to work on it.
And Ray, they're taking applications now to study these tubes. If you want to put yours in,
I think nano nerds should put in an application together.
No, let's leave it to the big boys. Actually,
but Ken, we're talking, that's a decade away. That's a lot of patience, right? Something like that. Well, that's a lot you're describing there.
That's right. The earliest opportunity to launch would be 2026. There's a follow-on opportunity in 2028. The 26 opportunity would have the samples back in 2031. So maybe
I want to be around
that by 2 years, maybe for a 2028 launch.
Well, let me ask this. I am very anxious. You know, I would love to live long enough for the samples to come back. But what happened to the water and the atmosphere on Mars? What are the theories? Why did it all? What's a lesson that we? Is there a lesson we could learn from what happened to Mars? Where did it all go, man? If there was life
it's and one
lakes,
of the big,
nobody
one
knows.
Of the big questions.
Did somebody pull the plug and all the water drained away, or where is the water?
Well, it's a safe bet to say that a lot of it escaped to space, and the remainder, you know, reacted with the crust, reacted with the rocks on the surface of Mars. You know, tiny, tiny, wispy traces are left in the atmosphere. But the Martian atmosphere is about 1% of the Earth's atmospheric density, and Mars's atmosphere is mostly made of carbon dioxide.
How does water go to space?
Well, it just floats to the top of the atmosphere and evaporates right off the top, just like cup of tea in the morning, you know.
Okay.
The cup with the water inside is Mars and its ocean, or Mars and its rivers and lakes, and then the steam rising off the top is Mars's atmosphere, and it floats away. So the way I think about it anyway, and there are people who devote their whole careers to studying, you know, this sort of and modeling this unfolding process of how a planet in the most broadest sense evolves over time. But Mars is much smaller than Earth. The thing that ultimately drives the evolution of a planet, the dynamics of a planet, the internal dynamics of a planet that in turn, you know, on Earth drive plate tectonics. So
it's a molten core.
Is exactly molten core. And why molten? Well, to some extent, it's just a lot of rock pressing in on itself. But from another point of view, it's radioactive decay. So what's the engine that provides the heat for the internal dynamics of the planet to continue and to evolve over time? It's the decay of radioactive elements ultimately inside the rocks of the planet. And in this sense, it doesn't have to be, you know, you don't have to think of like chunks of plutonium or chunks of, you know, of uranium ore or something. It's just there's radioactive elements distributed through all the rocks that make up the planet, even on the surface, and they're decaying all the time. And so when you have a larger chunk of rock, you have more of that, you know, radioactive elemental fuel to continue to drive that heat engine inside a planet. Well, then, as you said, it keeps the core molten, and it's the spinning of the core and the, you know, against the mantle, etc.
Which creates the magnetic fields.
Which creates the magnetic field. We call that the planetary dynamo. So this is just our model, our broad model of how a planet works like this. It generates a magnetic field. All the time, the sun, which is providing all this valuable